Welcome to the 17th episode of the Nonstop Podcast with Pooja. With me, I have Gintara. Gintara has many laurels to her name, and she is a woman of the hour for me today. She's a psychologist, an anthropologist, a brave activist. So, Gintara, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm Gintara Lütke. Currently, I'm a psychologist, but I also have two organizations now that both focus on menopause. That's Brave Flower and the Lithuanian Menopause Association. Also, I'm working with people with disabilities. And in general, I have quite a broad background because I used to work with children. And then I went slightly into human rights, but it was more like volunteering, but still, you know, when you spend so much time doing something, it's kind of weird, doesn't matter that it doesn't pay. And yeah, then I'm also studying now. So I do many different kinds of things, but now number one is menopause in my life. I mean, the topic itself, not the condition.
Yeah. No, but of course, I think not everybody is so happy when they say the word menopause, but you seem, but I'm sure the happiness sprues from the very fact that you're very involved in the subject and that it has given you a lot of satisfaction and reward. It is a taboo, right? Menopause is a taboo, and it's not a word that's commonly like hustled or, you know, spoken about in the society simply because it's related to a very difficult situation or a phase of life for women. But let's just track back and let's learn your background before we go into what you do with menopause and women. So you are a psychologist, right? And where did you get the psychology degree and how did you want to be a psychologist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I actually found my diary from when I was like maybe 10 years old, and it's written there that I was like, I'm planning to become a psychologist. I'm really surprised how come I knew such a term, a psychologist, when I was 10 years old. I don't know how, but I probably heard of it somewhere. And it did come true, right? When I was 16, I went to finish my high school to the United Kingdom. And one of the options to study was psychology. And I definitely knew I would do it. And I knew I would go and study it. So I kind of chose it at a higher level. And then I started studying it at university. I focused on positive psychology mostly. So my first year I spent in Australia. I was planning to stay in Australia forever, but stuff happened and I had to come back to Europe. And I always kind of knew that I would like to try living in the Netherlands. And well, lucky I was. Actually, there was a program in English to study psychology. So I went to Leiden and I finished my bachelor's and master's there. And then I had to come back during COVID to Lithuania. And I just kept on studying psychology, so I have my master's in the health and medical psychology, but I also, now I'm finishing my postgraduate sort of degree in cognitive behavioral therapy, so I'll be a psychotherapist as well.
That's very interesting. I've never heard the word positive psychology in my life before. So what is it? And I'm sure CBT, you know, the most commonly known term now, that a lot of people probably tuned into adolescents on Netflix, and everyone is more aware of just therapy and what benefits that come with it. So what kind of psychology do you practice in, and what do you believe is the best school for you in psychology?
Yeah, it's very hard to say what's the best school, because yes, cognitive behavioral therapy is kind of proven to be the most effective, but in fact, it just because there is a lot of money coming into researching it. What we generally see that many different kinds of therapies work, as long as a person actually engages in that work and does something, that pretty much everything works. So it really depends on the person, what they choose to do, what path they choose to go. Yeah, so in cognitive behavioral therapy, it used to be a little bit dry, sort of thoughts, changing thoughts and behaviors. It used to be only behaviors, so it has a long history. But now you can see a lot of positive psychology actually coming into it, and that would be focusing not only on the negative, like how to solve the problems and fix them and make those problems better, but also focusing on the positive aspects of human life and the working on them more, right? So so meditation also comes into that, and many different practices that invite you to enjoy life, you know, because not everything is bad. They invite you to also focus on the good.
Yeah, and what is the common thing that goes behind the doors of therapy and cognitive behavioral psychotherapy? Because when you say psychotherapy, instantly everybody takes a walk back and they're like, okay, this is serious, you know. And there's also a lot of medicinal aspect behind therapy, human sciences, and how to regulate your moods. So what would you think, I mean, from all your studies, you studied, you know, across different countries, different continents, I'm sure the approach to human life must be very different from one place to the other. And so is the line of understanding of therapy. So what would you say from your studies was the most, you know, kind of your taking back with you aspect in therapy in general?
Well, the thing is that I lived in United Kingdom, Australia, Netherlands, Lithuania, they are all very similar, you know,
yeah.
And we all learn from the same books.
Yeah.
You know, most of the research is happening in the US, like United Kingdom, Netherlands does a lot of research. So a lot of that psychology is focused on the West. I really like cultural psychology. I'm definitely not an expert in that, but it really shows how other cultures can be really different. And you can see if always the main two distinctions are made when they are giving us examples is like between China and the US. They are considered to be on the two different ends of the spectrum, like on cultural dimensions. So yeah, I myself kind of, I really like psychotherapy. Yeah, it sounds very serious, but it just, so everyone who finishes psychology is as a psychologist, no matter what they do, and you become a psychotherapist when you finish extra 4 years. So it's like a doctor.
Yeah.
Not many people know that, but psychologists also study for 10 years. Yeah, so psychotherapy is just, you choose one type of psychotherapy that you like as a specialist, so in my case, CBT. And yeah, and then you learn that, and it's just the talking part, right? It's nothing very mysterious or serious. We cannot prescribe any medication. But what I like doing is I definitely focus a lot on the body too, because I believe they are one thing, you know? So if the body feels good, then the mind also, and vice versa. That's why I always ask, how much sport do you do? What vitamins are you taking? Everything. I think sometimes people are confused why I'm doing that, but I also ask about sleep, everything.
And I think that's a good approach. And I also was very starstruck, kind of the aspect that you studied in Oxford. So what was your biggest takeaway from Oxford, and what was the journey towards Oxford like?
Yeah, so I didn't go there to university. I finished the international baccalaureate program there, but we did hang out a lot with the students. I also, before that, I spent some time at Harvard, but just like also just living there and hanging around, not studying. But being in those environments, it's kind of interesting. People are very, very smart. You just want to listen to them. Like, it's really, I don't know, it's a really strange feeling. In general, I really like the atmosphere of any university. You kind of feel, you know, that desire for knowledge and everything is like in the air. You can definitely feel that when you're in Oxford. still, when we talk about Harvard, Oxford, whatever, it's very Western. So, yeah, of course, they are the ones usually writing the books and we are studying from them. But there is nothing too special that I really like learned that it opened up my life or whatever. But it's nice to be there.
Yeah, and what would you say? You said you love cultural psychology, and I'm sure, you know, we are all working towards being like the West, you know, looking like the West, even, you know, of a different ethnicity. I think it's so romanticized and it's the next wave of life. Everybody wants to be like the West, so much so in the world today that we have, you know, more wars than we have, you know, happier human beings. So as psychologists, you come in and you're most relevant in today's space of time, because I'm sure 10 years ago or 15 years ago, therapy or just human sciences in general was given much lesser importance than, I don't know, in terms of like medical sciences. So I would like to ask, you know, what if you have traveled a lot and have you, what was your cultural psychological difference that you found from the West to the East, you know, if you had any observations?
Yeah, my observations would be, yeah, so it's, first thing is that, yeah, we kind of, psychology is sort of led by the West and everything, and it happened because after all the world wars, they had so many people that had a huge problem because they were fighting in the fields, right? PTSD, all those problems. That's why psychology became like needed. Now we see that it's needed, not only because of the words, but I think every person should at least sometimes see a psychologist to discuss certain things and to sort some things out. Cultural psychology I like because, one step back is that, so West, but now we can see that people are more and more leaning into the East, right? Yeah. They realize that, oh, we...
the roots are coming from that.
Yeah, not even... Okay, maybe not even, like, it's just... They're trying to become more in tune with the nature, you can see, you know? Many people started doing yoga or whatever, because it's not enough. Like, you need to work on your sort of soul, whatever that means. You need to do something more to feel alive, and that's why all the philosophies that come from the East are sometimes so absorbed, you know, like Buddhism,
whatever.
What's the
philosophy from the East you like?
Oh, me? I used to be really into all sorts of philosophies and reading a lot about them. I wouldn't say I have any like favorite one. I think as you keep reading, you kind of always can pick one thing that you like and then incorporate that into your life. I did spend some time in India, and I was working with a doctor that's an Ayurvedic doctor, and I really liked how they approach. So if there is a problem, they don't focus just on that problem. They focus on much more, you know? It's like not a single thing that they work. It's not, oh, I have like knee pain. Then they will not look only at the knee pain. And I think this is what I really like about certain philosophies, that they talk about the connection between all different human parts, which we don't do in the West so much.
Yeah, I think that's very lovely and it's well put. And I was also thinking, you know, in reflection from what you said, that you work a lot with Ayurvedic and you have an Ayurvedic background and you learned a bit more on Ayurveda and how it affects or how it heals, a lot of therapeutic aspect. And you're from a part of a world where there's a lot of trauma. There is even second generational trauma, you know, and there is always in the edge of whether there could be a potential breakout of war. And this is for whole of Europe. Europe is always in a burning West situation. So what would you say that you took away the most in respect of Ayurveda and trauma? How does trauma work in like body, you know, body pain, muscles? How does trauma translate to body?
My experience with Ayurveda was many years ago, so I probably wouldn't even manage now to explain it through the Ayurvedic perspective. Too complicated for me, but in general trauma, it's sometimes when we talk about trauma, we think like, oh yeah, so scary, so bad, but we don't even realize that that person will probably will feel that trauma forever. Even when you're not thinking about it, the body is like has its registered somewhere. It because it's useful for the body to remember that, wow, something bad happened. I need to take this into account. I need to keep it in the body because that might happen again. I need to be prepared, right? So it's just like a survival mechanism for the body. And what we see, like, if we go back to, let's say, childhood trauma and menopause. If you are a child and you experienced trauma, let's say, and not one, it's not that someone may... example of a trauma would be parents divorced. Another example, you were like sexually abused, physically abused, you were not, you didn't feel loved, that's trauma. If you get four of those traumas, the chances of you being really sick later in life really increase. If you have six traumas in your life, in childhood especially, this is the most critical part because this is when the brain is forming. You have six of those, your chances of trying to commit a suicide increased by 3 to 6 times. So it's really, it goes with you through your life and it affects you later in life, especially in menopause, because in menopause the brain is being reorganized. You sort of get a new brain and many, many brain structures, they are changing, and like amygdala, which is responsible for the emotions, it becomes reactivated. And those things that you had experienced as a child are starting to come back. And you cannot really distinguish like what is happening, when did it happen, you're asking yourself. You kind of know that it happened 40 years ago, but you are starting to feel it again. And those women start to have way more menopause symptoms compared to those who have no trauma history. So it really affects you, and it might come back later in life even stronger because the brain is restructuring itself. So yeah, trauma, it really sort of, it is with us forever and ever. You can work on it, yeah, but you never know when it might come back. Something might trigger it, the brain starts changing structures, and you're like again facing that PTSD that you maybe I've forgotten now.
I think this is so amusing for me, and you said it so elaborately and well that I only want to ask you more questions and pick your mind on it.
I really want to say a lot. It's really like difficult for me to even control myself.
No, but I think it's so interesting because I feel like, you know, there's a lot on the internet today. Everybody picks up something, and then there is a, you know, this medial understanding of it on an extreme direction. But I've read a lot on two, you know, effective combination or reliance on each other, which is trauma and body pain. I understand that trauma, you said that childhood trauma reflects on most of your adulthood, not just in terms of diseases, but also in terms of your behavioral patterns and how you just view yourself. For me, I just want to know that you said parents divorcing is one of the six, you know, trauma responses. Mm-hmm. And you said there are six main trauma.
And ten in total. Like there is an adverse childhood experiences questionnaire, and it has 10 main traumas, which is now we encourage all the doctors to use the questionnaire because these are risk factors for many diseases, including cancer, heart diseases, all sorts of whatever you think of. Those traumas can influence it.
How do they influence? How does direct, a medical condition it is related to trauma. Trauma is more on the end of experiences of what a person faces, or is it, it's very momentary. How do you think that 40 years later it translates to a medical condition?
Yeah, so when we react to trauma, it's not only an emotional reaction. It's not that, oh, I'm crying, I'm scared, and that's it. As I said, it really enters your body, and the body and the brain are calculating chances of survival. And what happens is that it's a stress response, basically. And it's not that easy to turn it off, especially if the person is not perceiving any safety. So let's say, yeah, the trauma happens, it's very scary, and there are certain protective factor that could help deal with it. So loving parents, I don't know, psychological help, well, whatever you can think of, I don't know, that would make a child feel safe, right? In absence of those things, the body cannot relax, right? Because it's not safe. That means in animal language, animal world would be that I can die any moment. Like someone will attack me and will eat me, and that's it. So the body is not just looking around, it's very alert. And that is stress response. And stress is not good, right? Yeah. All the cortisol, whatever, increases. And we know that such things, you lose all the balance, hormonal balance, everything. So the systems are now overworking. The brain is overworking. The brain starts to interpret different signals not the way it should interpret, because the brain perceives it as danger. So basically, in short, the body is working to protect you from further danger. And that means the stress response never stops, and it wears the system off. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's ask like a fun quiz. So those who are listening to this podcast and are at this point, I'm sure they're really into it. You know, just on a very colloquial sense. For example, I'm in my early 30s. You know, somebody who's listening to it, or late 20s. I have a lot of back pain. You know, there could be, of course, a sport reason, probably into some injuries and et cetera, et cetera. But just a back pain that comes out of nowhere. You know, what is a trauma response according, you know, to kind of like behavioral sciences, you know, just as a back pain? You know, what trauma would you relate it to?
So the science, I'm not sure about the science, but I'm pretty sure that if you went to a psychologist, not just a regular psychologist, the one who's interested in more topics and is more into, like, I don't know, spiritual stuff or whatever, they would ask you to examine your thoughts, they would assess your trauma to see if you actually had trauma, how much of it, how many traumatic experiences. They would probably ask you to work on that. Just in general, of course. But the other thing, they would probably ask you to sort of feel, like to meditate, do some sort of exercises, and to feel your body, to find where the trauma might be like hidden in your body, where you store it, right? So let's say, I had thyroid gland problems, not quite sure why, but then I went to one healer and she said, like, well, your thyroid gland is in your neck. And she asked me to think about whether I allow myself to speak up when I need to, you know, if I am using my voice the way I should. And I realized, like, no. And it was really interesting. And then I kind of worked, of course, I worked with medical doctors, because I cannot just rely on some random advice from some healers. But then as well, I started working on myself and speaking up. And yeah, I thought, now I don't have that problem. Like, thyroid gland problem solved. So the back, well, I don't know, maybe you're just storing really a lot of tension there, and like meditation or some sort of practice like that could help with that?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because, you know, especially I come from India and they really rely a lot. I mean, our generation is kind of like completely, you know, I would say almost the West. We think like the West, we act like the West, you know, and we live on the internet. So I think our generation, everybody is an internet generation. But a generation before, if we had any kind of, you know, health ailments like fever or like, the immediate answer would be like, oh, not okay, take this medicine, you'd feel better. But what did you do? You know, what did I do? And there is a saying in India or like Indian, just historical medicine or beliefs that everything comes from the grandma's, you know, secret relief structure. Mm-hmm. So the grandma always has a relief to offer for you. And you can think, oh, how much was the grandma educated? Probably, I don't know, a third grade dropout. How did she come up with this? But she accumulated a lot of these behavioral understanding from the previous generation. And I think in today's world, we often like only go with medical sciences, which is accurate. But also what you did was you did a preemptive or like a pre-measure on understanding the healing aspect as well. And which makes me understand how well the mind and body works. Because we underestimated too much. I think we all like put a lot of stress on the body and then the mind reacts to us in a different way. They're like, oh, you think you're stressing the body? Let me teach you how the body's stressed and then you feel pain. So thank you so much for elaborating that for us. I think it was, I don't know, for me it was like inspiring almost to listen to how this works. But now I have to turn to the page where I discuss about all the incredible work that you're doing at the moment. For menopause, for pre-menopause, and also for women. You have an NGO called Brave Flowers, and you are also a founding member of the Lithuanian Menopause Association. This is incredible. I'm in my late 20s, and I've suffered with a medical condition which couldn't be diagnosed, called vaginismus. Not very often that I had the courage to talk about it, because for the longest time I've been a child that has been completely healthy, or a young adult or a woman. And then when the condition happened to me, I was not able to explain to anyone which was near and dear to me that I have vaginismus, and it has nothing to do with my body, but it has something to do with my mind.
Yeah.
So it was then I realized how important subconscious mind is, and it's a very interesting but a very scary place. So I'm sure menopause or pre-menopause has a lot to do with subconscious mind. And congratulations for all your efforts. So I will let you take the stage and let us, you know, be, you know, empowered with your knowledge on how you came upon this activism of menopause, how men see it, what women actually go through it, and why do women end up with pre-menopause?
So thank you. It's kind of crazy because every person born with the ovaries will have menopause. And then when we think about this fact now that we founded the Lithuanian Menopause Association only a month and a half ago, it's that new. It makes me go like, what? Like half of the even more than half of the population of Lithuania is women. And this topic, like, how come no one else did that before us? It's interesting to think about it, and I think it highlights a bigger problem that we have. Menopause is a very natural thing. Every woman will go through it. There is no way around it. Unless you die before menopause, but no other way. No need to be scared of it. Yes, some women do feel bad. And what makes it worse is that they don't feel free to talk about it. There is nothing shameful about it because you cannot have children anymore, right? Well, which is, I don't know, normal, that just how the nature made it, right? So, but there is still stigma. And I think it's because women feel like they are not needed anymore. And it's not that they themselves came up with this idea that they are not needed anymore, not useful anymore. It's basically the society made them feel this way. If we take the US or Lithuania, I mean, very different cultures, maybe not so much now anymore, but before, right? So in the US in the 60s, one doctor wrote a book where he called menopause a disease. He said that when the woman enters menopause, she's not a woman anymore, right? But not a man either, but not a woman, right? And that she becomes really not beautiful and kind of useless and things like that. And that book became a bestseller. So many women and men read the book and they thought like, wow, menopause is the end. Like, not the woman is no longer beautiful, useful and everything. What happened in Lithuania is that when the Soviet Union started forming, it was kind of liberal, right? It was the first country in the world to legalize abortion. But then what they saw was that it was not useful anymore because many people were just getting married, divorcing, having abortions, having as many kids as they want, like doing whatever. And they were like, well, it's not economically useful for us at all. So they became really, really strict as a result. And they started focusing a lot of their attention on young couples, the one that can have babies. And everyone who couldn't reproduce wasn't useful anymore. So even young women who couldn't reproduce, they were like, looked like, what the English word? They were not respected, basically. So automatically, older women were not respected either. They were not seen as useful. And we can see that to this day, I think. Because when I see my mom talking to her friends, who are over 50 years old, they are hiding the fact that they are in menopause. They're like, no, it's not because of that. Like, no, they are not talking about it. As if it's shameful to admit that, yeah, this part of life is over. But in fact, it should be a celebrated part of life. Because, I don't know, probably you already have your kids, you have your career, even if you don't have kids, it's also fine. Right now you can just focus on yourself, no painful periods anymore, nothing. And you can see that, especially in the US, age 60 is about the happiest age that a person feels, you know? So not like when you're 20s, when you're 60. Yeah, so... yeah, still taboo exists. We are trying to break it. The other thing that women should know that, the medium age of menopause in the West is 51, but there is perimenopause, which is a preparation for menopause, and it can happen 10 years before, and like the whole process. And then you hit menopause, it's 12 months without periods. And then immediately the next day you're post-menopause. So menopause is just one day, like 12 months without a period. And then you're post-menopause. But the thing is that the range is still quite wide. You can hit menopause when you're 45 and it's normal. And 55 is also normal. If we talk about those who hit menopause at 45, and perimenopause, as I said, is normal to have it 10 years before, means that if you are 35 and start experiencing symptoms, it's normal. So that's what I'm trying to tell my friend. I know you are all young, but you're like 30 plus. Be ready. It can happen and it's okay, but you should know it. And if you know it, you're educated about it, you can start preparing yourself and you can pretty much avoid most of the symptoms.
What is perimenopause? I understand it's a very preparatory stage that the body goes through, but of course it seems like it's in preparation for almost a decade before the actuals happen, right? Like the body never crashes one day. It's always giving you reactions and you have to pay attention. So I'm just curious, like what really happens in the perimenopause stage?
Mm-hmm. So the woman's body is wired to carry a baby. that's why we have, I know not everyone can have it, but just let's say, like, let's not talk about all the other cases. Let's say it's prepared to have a baby. That's why we have the ovaries, right, the womb, and it's directly connected to our brain. And everything in puberty is preparing us, like, for the baby, right, and all the menstruation, everything that happens, you know, it's always, every month we are preparing to have a baby. And basically then we start running out of the follicles, which have the eggs usually. So it, because we are born with a certain amount and we are slowly running out of it. And then we hit that point when we don't have that much, that many, and the body starts getting the signals like, hey, the ovaries, you know, you won't need them anymore very soon. So the whole body has to rearrange itself, including the brain, because it would be too much energy wasted for the brain to keep the structure it has at the moment, because it's wired to have a baby. So if the ovaries stop working, it means we won't have a baby. That's why everything is like shifting. And the ovaries are producing hormones. It's estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. Those are crucial for our health. They run most of our body, but we are running out of them. So the body comes into a shock, and it takes a while for the body to get used to living without those hormones. Or, I mean, they are not, they don't just manage. It's not just that. There are other hormones that take over, or like other structures that take over. Other body parts are also producing those hormones. So it's not that we are like at zero, but still it's a huge shock for the body. So, and the body is feeling it, and it's preparing for a complete shutdown of the ovaries.
Wow. that was like in my head, I was like imagining a whole war, you know, that the body is fighting. And yeah, I also would like to kind of like just track a little back. So you say that the preparation stage is called perimenopause, and then the menopause happens. So, and I'm sure in like today's world, everybody wants to look younger, and everybody wants to feel younger, and to an unnatural extent that they are revising their youth to an extent that they are getting like procedures, harmful, not so harmful, you know, on their faces, on their body, on their outer appearance. I'm sure, you know, in order to avoid wrinkles, we use like, I don't know, niacinamide and retinol and all of that. I'm sure the estrogen and the other, you know, the body chemicals that you said is very important to us. Do you, in your, you know, activism, not just say that be mentally prepared? Because when somebody says be mentally prepared, you start to overthink. But what would be the right approach is that you're kind of like working towards, you know, protecting yourself. So do you suggest a certain set of activities that women do in their late 30s, you know, and when they start feeling that the periods are stopping, and that, you know, what kind of like betterment that you can do to your health? Do you have to eat a certain way? Do you have to do anything certainly, or nothing at all?
Yeah, so yeah, I see a lot of courses where they teach you how to eat according to your menstrual cycle, like what sports to do, and you have to keep changing it every week. Yeah, it's amazing if you have the cognitive and the, I don't know, all sorts of abilities to stick to those things, but very often they result in sort of like disorders, eating disorders, or we start doing too much sports or whatever. So the very basic thing that I would say every woman should do is start lifting weights, because we start losing muscle. Also, we start losing bone mass, right? So osteoporosis is quite a big thing, a big problem. Sports would help with that. So definitely lifting weights and eating more protein. That would be two main advice. The other thing is, if the woman is healthy and then the doctor is fine with it and everything, she, once she starts feeling first signs of perimenopause, like irregular periods, or maybe some mood changes, well, whatever, there are 100 symptoms, possible symptoms. So whatever she feels from that list, and the doctor thinks she's entering the perimenopause, she can start taking hormonal replacement therapy. So it's just taking estrogen and progesterone. Those things really help to prevent certain diseases that might occur later in life, including osteoporosis, which is the bone density problem, right? In simple terms. I realize I'm talking a lot of like things people might not know. Just like consider taking hormonal replacement therapy once you're in perimenopause. And other things is just more protein and stop smoking also. Stop smoking. Smoking is really bad. Yeah. It might make you hit menopause earlier, bone density really suffers from smoking, everything suffers from smoking, really quit smoking.
I'm sure. I just want to ask like two questions. So I've read a lot on protein adverse theory. I in fact come from a part of the world where protein is almost alien in our diet and it's just hiding in some kind of like pulses or fiber. Like I come from the south of India where like we are more on the seafood diet or chicken at the most, you know, and we barely choose a lot of non-vegetarian food, which is major source of protein, and we kind of stick to vegetarian food. And I realized that once I moved countries, you know, I have to eat protein to survive because of the cold. I also have read a lot of adverse theories on how overconsumption of protein could like make you feel like, you know, like your body could feel like acid reflux and like a lot of associated symptoms. And also you spoke about hormonal therapy. I'll ask two questions in one go. So how do you, like, is it like injections that you get for these, you know, like diminishing estrogen levels and all of that? Or is it like in terms of medical, other tablets or something like that?
Yeah, so talking about protein, yeah, it's a different story a little bit in Asia. We see women might experience different symptoms, especially those who eat soy products, because those kind of have estrogen. In India, women hit menopause earlier on average. I think it's 46 compared to the West 51. I think I might be mistaken, but it's definitely earlier. Not sure why. Might be because of pollution, maybe some health things, maybe diet, so many different theories. But in the other story also is that many people in Asia cannot really like digest lactose that well. But people in the West, I don't know, in general, what they see is people don't eat enough protein. And there are a lot of scared that, it will ruin, I don't know, your kidneys, liver, whatever, I don't know. But in general, they see that if you are a healthy individual, it's fine to eat more. So unless you feel, I don't know, digestion problem, then probably you should, or you should ideally consult with your doctor, not listen to a podcast and make the decision, but you know. Yeah. So yeah, but I don't know, with protein in general, as you age, you need to eat more and more because you lose muscles, you lose your bones, you need to keep up. Otherwise, it might end in a disability, right? Because if you break your bone, especially a hip, like a lot of people, okay, 40 people then have a disability for the rest of their life. 40% of people when they break a hip. That's a lot. And it's the risk of breaking a hip after menopause, it's quite high because you fall and the bone is weak and that's it. That's why I would really encourage women thinking about increasing their protein or also consulting with a doctor. Hormonal replacement therapy is not injections, it's usually tablets or gels or plaster. That's something that can be absorbed through the skin. This is the safest form because when you take a tablet, it has to go through all of your organs and it might cause some problems, like also problems with liver. But when you use it through skin, it really decreases risk of all sorts of diseases. The most talked about is breast cancer and like heart diseases or whatever. But in general, it's quite safe. And if you are a healthy woman, I would advise you to go on hormonal replacement therapy.
Yeah, and of course, I have to talk about towards the very end of the podcast about your whole initiative and activism on. Not just bravely talking about it, because so many topics that we touched upon in the whole course of menopause or just trauma and sciences is still a topic, especially I have observed. I come from a nation of extrovertism. We speak. We speak our problems, we speak our happiness, we speak our sorrows. Everything is about the more you speak, the better you feel. In the West, there's a lot of individualism and internalizing. So I'm sure, like, even with menopause, even though it's more common to talk about difficult topics here, there's not a lot of kind of enough knowledge surrounding it. And you are kind of doing it. You are bridging the gaps. So what are your NGO's initiatives, and what do you feel like people should do when they have this thought process, or how can they, you know, kind of be involved with the NGO, and what is all that cool stuff that you do with menopause?
Yeah, so I started an NGO called Brave Flower because not many people were talking about it. Surprisingly, now in this year, like end of 2024, now we see more and more doctors started talking about it, more podcasts, things got, because there was nothing, literally nothing. So I started it, because no one was really talking about it, and there was no NGO dedicated to this. And I realized that we have to remind people that menopause is natural. You should talk about it. You must talk about it. Not everyone feels awful during this phase, but there are people actually suffering from it, because the hormonal changes can be quite drastic. And not only about how you feel, but it can have long-term effects like osteoporosis and things like that, which is a huge problem. And women should know about it. They should be informed that if they don't take more protein, they don't do sport, they don't take hormonal replacement therapy, they are at risk of increasing osteoporosis, as well as depression. The risk of depression also increases. Many risks of diseases increases. Women should know it so that they could make a choice. Like, maybe someone knows all the risks and says, no, I don't want that. You know, I don't want HRT, the hormones. I will just live without them. I'll do some herbs and that's it, you know. But they should be informed, and they are not informed. I see that very often. Women, when they call me and they're like, I'm 49, I don't know what's happening. Like, menopause is happening. So yeah, but I went to my doctor and she said that I'm still menstruating. That means it's not menopause. Like, yeah, but there's perimenopause, like preparation for that. And this is when you feel most of the symptoms. This is the most brutal part. Later on, it starts like evening out. So I realized that women don't know that. But I also realize that doctors don't know it.
Yeah.
That's why we now have a Lithuanian Menopause Association, which is for the doctors. And then Brave Flower now is for women. So that we have to educate both. Because, okay, let's say I have a woman called me. I tell her, like, oh, go to your doctor, talk about hormonal replacement therapy. And she goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, like, you're crazy. You know, it increases the risk of cancer and whatever, go away. And that's it, that's the end of the story. So they have to be informed as well. So that's what I'm doing. And we have now more doctors joining us.
Well, I think all of this is very exciting on your page, and I hope the Brave Flower has more flowers and they are more brave, like you are. You came and you put across such a brave front, and for me, that I've interacted with you and I see you, you're very warm and you're more open to sharing, you know, like really eccentric ideas in a very laughable manner. I think there's not a lot of, like, aspect to serious topics like this, because every topic should be seen with a more on a solution front and a more embracing front, right? Because what happens when you lose something? You grieve and you go on, like life goes on. I think it should be a similar front. Of course, in this case, luckily there are solutions, and I hope more people kind of like know the solutions and can make a decision. We've come to the end of the podcast, but I cannot leave you without asking my favorite question to every guest possible. What's the book that changed your life, and what's the one movie that did so? If you don't want to say a movie, you can say a person.
Okay, so yeah, I'm not a big fan of movies. I started watching more of them during COVID. Oh, what a surprise, right? In general, I have a lot of Barbie dolls, so I really like the movie Barbie. Like, I was crying. So I really like really soft and beautiful movies, because thing. All the like horror movies or whatever, I don't think they are healthy for us, because the brain doesn't understand that it's a movie. Okay, it thinks it's real.
Yeah.
So I'm leaning more towards Barbies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And books, I read only scientific literature.
Wow, even better.
So I don't know. I think most of the scientific books can change your life, because you get very hands-on information, you know, how to heal yourself, what medicine to take. I read a lot of like medical literature, even though I'm not a doctor, but I'm really interested in that. So any medical book can change your life, because then you realize how your body works, and you start seeing yourself slightly differently. It's not just like, oh, I do whatever I want, you know, I'm here for a good time, not for a long time. No, once you know what's happening in your body, you're like, oh no, if I don't take care of myself, I will never have fun time. So any scientific book.
So what's the recent one you're reading?
What the book I'm reading now?
Yeah.
Menopause books now. The most recent one that I read was The Menopause Frame, I think it's called. It's by Lisa Mosconi. She's the best well-known researcher of female brain, especially when it comes to menopause. So I hope I didn't get her name wrong. But yeah, that's really interesting, and that's very, very useful and easy to understand for anyone.
Yeah. I think that was lovely. You said a very powerful statement towards the very end. You cannot have fun time until you look after yourself. So life is once, but you also need to be informed. So thank you very much, Gintare. It has been absolute pleasure of mine to have such a lovely, brave, and a very smart mind. Not very often that we get to interact with somebody who is both soft and very strong and activist and all of these wonderful things. So thank you for coming on the podcast, and I wish you the very best.
Thank you very much.